Sammy, thank you so much for coming on. I'm truly appreciative, and I'm humbled and grateful to hear your story. And I think it's important, and you and I can both agree, it's really important to document these stories, not even as a Jewish American, but just as a human to have these documented. And I think we could both agree on that. Sammy's a Holocaust survivor, but he's so much more than that. He's an educator, he's a motivational speaker, and he's lived a very full life. Sammy, I did a bunch of research on you before we, sat down to meet. And before we begin, I want to start with a quote that I saw on your website. You said, "I'm not what happened to me, I'm what I choose to be." This is a profound statement, especially from a survivor. Can you explain a little bit what this quote means to you and how you live by this?
I went through a lot in life. Nothing unusual. Every person has to overcome obstacles. But what happened to me does not define me. The first part of my life does not define me. It is the last part of my life that defines me, who I am, okay, what I am today. I'll give an example. It's a funny example, a stupid one, but it's a real one. I had a girlfriend, and when I introduced her to somebody else, or some of my friends, she used to extend her hand and she used to say, "Hi, my name is Anita. I'm bipolar." Who cares? Nobody asked you. But that was her idea. Identity. So people identify themselves by their spouse, how beautiful, the wife is, the beautiful home, how much money they make, and everything else. For me, the material achievements, what I had, what I lost, and everything else do not define me. What defines me is, okay, what I am doing today to make this a better, kinder world.
And I think someone who went through as much as you did, I think that's absolutely beautiful. Life's a journey. So can you tell me a little bit about when and where you were born? Can you just tell me a little bit about it, about your community, where you were born?
I was born in a city called Czernowitz. It was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. In an area called Bukovina. Bukovina was given to Romania, and the emperor, Franz Josef, was revered by the Jews. And a lot of the Jewish people have actually adopted the German culture. As a matter of fact, my parents talked among themselves in German. My first language was German. I haven't spoken it for over 70 years. But the interesting part is that everything was around the concept of the German culture. For to give an example, when we ate breakfast, my mother used to say, my sister was born after the war. I was born on December 21, 1939. And the war was already about close to 4 months, okay, was going on. But interestingly enough, my mother used to say, whoever finishes first the breakfast will be the Kaiser, okay, will be the champ. But they always used the word Kaiser. So you can see that people really, really, in their own minds, revered. Okay, the emperor, he was very good to the Jews. Czernowitz was a very Yiddish city, probably one of the most Yiddish cities. The Yiddish in Czernowitz is different than one in Poland or in Hungary. Like, for instance, Ich gai, okay, so they would say it in Polish. I say Ergei. Okay, so it's different, but we could understand each other and everything else. For the audience, for people that may not know, Yiddish is a combination of German and Hebrew words. So that was basically my background. To be honest with you, when we were deported, I was too young, only a year and a half. So obviously, I have no memory of that period of time. And until the Eichmann trial in Israel in 1961, the Holocaust survivors did not talk publicly, and they wanted their children to have a normal childhood, did not want to burden the children with those horror stories. I knew that I am a Holocaust survivor because my father talked a lot about the fact that from his family, from 42 people, only two survived. I also do not emphasize the pain that people went through. Every person that goes through an obstacle, it's very painful for them. So what I concentrate in is how was it possible that ordinary people from Germany, from Europe, other countries found that not only acceptable, but required to annihilate one group of people, the Jewish people. And you mentioned something in your introduction. I never considered myself that way, but people gave me that title. You mentioned educator. And many people believe that teacher and educator are interchangeable. But I was not sure why would some people call themselves teachers and some people educators. And as I decided to do the research, I found out they are not interchangeable. There is this distinct difference. A teacher is an instructor, and they concentrate primarily in what, where, and why. A teacher is what they do. It's their profession. An educator, on the other hand, okay, continues with his education or her education, and their primary interest is in how and why. How did it happen? Okay, why? Why do we have to teach about the Holocaust, about history in general? Why do we have to teach about math? About so it's a totally different concept, and for me, an educator is not somebody's profession, it's somebody's vocation.
Right. I want to go over the why and how in part two for sure. And we're gonna unpack all of that. Obviously, there's a lot to go over, but let's backtrack a bit. You were born in Bukovina. You said it's a very Yiddish city. Was it mixed at all, or it was
By the way, do
totally
you speak Yiddish?
abyssal.
Abyssal.
Abyssal. No, my father's Sephardic, but my mom's Ashkenazi, so I don't think my yeah, so I don't
When
think
is
my
this party? When is this party? From where?
Iran. Well, he was born in Israel. His parents were born in Iran.
Pardon me?
My father was born in Jerusalem, and his parents were born in Iran, Iran.
Okay. You
Yeah.
get thank you.
So, of course, of course. So, just to backtrack a little bit, you were born in a town in Romania called Bukovina. Can you explain sort of a little bit about that community? I know you said it was very Yiddish. Were there any non-Jews, or is it a totally Jewish community? And what did you know about Jewish life in that community in pre-war Europe?
As far as I know, it was a very large Jewish community. I don't want to put the number. I would say, I don't think I would exaggerate it, I would say about 40%. So it was a very, very Jewish, but I am not sure. At one time I knew, I didn't do the research lately, so I don't want to give the wrong numbers. But I believe I would say about 40% were Jewish people. One of the things that we have to understand is that Jews have lived under different regimes, different countries. So we were beholden to the benevolence of those regimes. And things have changed with the establishment of the State of Israel.
Of course.
But as far as I know, because of my parents adapting the German culture and everything else, I believe that life was good. Obviously, they were the wealthy people. They were also the poor people. And as far as I remember vaguely, Bahnhofstrasse was the dividing area between these two groups of people. And my parents lived on the lower, on the poorer side of Chernivtsi.
So I did want to learn a little bit more about your family history and your family. Can you tell me a little bit more about your mother and father and if you have any siblings?
Yes. My father was not born in Chernivtsi. He was an orphan of both of his parents. He was born in Vatra Dorne in Romania proper. My grandfather died before he was born. And my grandmother, unable to take care of 8 children during those days, for practical purposes, only the men provided for the family. My grandmother decided to take the 2 youngest kids and commit suicide. There was no income coming in. A stranger saved the children, but my grandmother did commit suicide. So my father grew up in an orphanage in Vienna, Austria. And at age 13, he was let go. He became streetwise. He had to fend for himself. And obviously, it's a different streetwise than today. That helped them during the war. It also helped them after the war when there was not enough food to feed the population. And he knew how to provide for the family. My mother, on the other hand, I know very little about her, but she was an uneducated woman. My grandfather had a store, did not allow her to go to school. She had to stay home, help provide for the family. In addition, she was also abused by her stepmother. But I teach the young people that in their entire life, there will never be anybody that will love them more than their own parents. They are willing to give up their lives for them. And I tell them, you may not like one of your parents because obviously they put restrictions. They don't want for us to make the same mistakes that they did, but we have to do it our own way. But I say, you may not like them, but love them. They did the best that they could. They know how. And whether you like it or not, you have the genes of both of your parents. I took my confidence from my father. I took my sensitivity from my mother. Unfortunately, I know very little about her, but what I do know is how they met. Both of them worked at the textile factory in Chernivtsi. And my father asked my mother, asked her out. She said, I'm very sorry, but I'm seeing somebody else. So my father said, you can go out with him as long as you want, but you will be mine. And they've been together for 65 years. Now that is confidence. The other interesting thing is, in Yiddish, there is a song called Yosele. And that was the name of my mother's first boyfriend. And she used to love that song, used to play. But my father was not jealous. And he let her play. You love her play. It's, you know, interesting. From my father, from what I do know, is that vaguely, because my memory is not what it used to be, that he was in the Romanian military, in the cavalry. But being literate, unlike most of the other soldiers, He was mostly in the administrative part. He was not what I call a foot soldier.
Right.
Okay. But he was in the Romanian military, yes. And like anything else, it depends how you react. You cannot legislate how somebody feels. Was there Jew hatred? Was there anti-Jewish sentiments? Discrimination? Absolutely. But it also depends how you react to it. And I'll give an example from myself. People have a certain perception of what a Jew is supposed to look like. Apparently, I don't have those features. And my name is spelled with two M's, the German spelling. So a lot of people used to tell all kinds of stupid jokes, different comments about Jewish people. And it's very important to be proud of your heritage. And I used to look at him and I said, "Do you know who you're talking to? I'm Jewish." Oh, we did not mean you. We meant them. And that's what I teach the young people, that we hate people because we don't know them. We don't know them because we hate them. So, and by talking to somebody, not stereotyping and going on the slogans, and by talking to them, you will find out that you have more in common than differences. And this is one way to bring people together.
Absolutely, I agree. I think sometimes a lot of people are not actually driven by hatred. A lot of the times it's just fear. They don't, it's the fear of the unknown.
Or ignorance.
Absolutely, or ignorance. So I'm curious what we're gonna talk about the experience in the Holocaust in part two, but if you don't mind me asking, what was the fate of your parents?
The what?
The fate of your parents.
In those particular days, we did not have the distinction like today, Hasidim, Orthodox, conservative, Reform. They have some other denominations, Universalist, whatever. In those days, yes, we had Hasidim. Okay, very religious people, but it mostly was either modern Orthodox or secular. There was nothing in between. So obviously I grew up religious. I obviously knew discrimination because of it, especially in schools after the war. And we'll talk more about it. But interestingly enough, there is even today a Jewish organization which is religious and a Zionist organization. I don't know if you're familiar with B'nai Akiva.
Sounds familiar.
And I was part of it. And I can tell you a funny story.
Sure.
In 1947, we're going a little bit ahead, but it's apropos. Halutzim, okay, pioneers, 1947, they came to our small town where we lived in Romania after the war. And I was about 6.5 years old. And one of the Halutzim came to me and asked, "Do you want to go to Palestine?" I said, "No." "Are you a Zionist?" I said, "No." He said, "I will circumcise you." Suddenly, I wanted to go to Palestine. Suddenly, I became a Zionist. So a little fear, okay, can change your perspective.
Absolutely. So we learned a little bit about your parents, back in those days. There's, either you're modern Orthodox or secular. I'm curious, what happened to your parents? Did they survive the war?
Yes, all three of us were in the camp. We were not deported by the Germans. We were deported by the Romanians. So being in a labor camp, unlike the concentration camps, where when you came to the camp, the commander or some many times the doctor, whose job is to save lives, would be in the middle and divide the group in two. One group would be murdered right away, the other one would be become slaves. In labor camp, they did not murder you. Okay, you died through attrition, which means they worked you to death. They gave instructions. If you did not follow properly the instructions, they would use an example in front of everybody. They would beat you to death. And that was a normal thing that they did, many times just for fun. They would starve you to death. People died of disease. And many times, the commander or some other high-ranking Nazi officer would use the people as a shooting target. So there is a huge difference between the two type of camps. Personally, I do not like to generalize because it depended where the camps were, okay, who was the commander, who were the guards. There were so many, many factors. And that's why I do not like to generalize. But I want to give you one example that I heard from another survivor that told me how life was in a labor camp. For breakfast, they gave you a slice of bread. And again, I'm not generalizing. It was not in every labor camp. You would have to work for half a day. During the lunch, they gave you another slice of bread. You had to work for the rest of the day. In the evening, they gave you soup. But it's not the soup that we are familiar with. It was mostly water and salt makes you thirsty. To understand what it means starving to death. Let's assume that you're a man weighing 180, 200 pounds. If you were lucky and you survived, okay, by the end of the war, when the camp was liberated, you weighed 65, maybe 70 pounds.
Oh my God.
Walking skeletons. The bones were there. It was, as a Holocaust survivor, I don't talk about the pain, but I cannot imagine what people went through and how. I talked to a lot of other survivors and I asked them, what was in your mind? How did you deal with it? And he said, we wanted to survive because we wanted to know if anybody else from our family survived or not. And we can talk about it again on the next
part
episode.
Two, yeah.
But it's important for us to understand something. People always think that the Jews went to slaughter like sheep. And that's not true because, okay, as you know, on Yom HaShoah, we commemorate the first Hebrew day of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. But people think of resistance only militarily. But keep in mind, in the labor camp, in the concentration camps, they had schools. They taught clandestinely, okay, children, okay, how to read, how to pray. They used to put film, okay, at the same and time.
This is okay, all a secret, right?
Yes. Okay. They, for instance, they kept the holidays. That was the religious, educational resistance. There was also at the same time, there was the humanitarian resistance. If you had a crumb of bread and somebody was a worse shape than you are, okay, you would take the piece of crumb of bread and give it to the other person. There was also the understand the religious resistance, besides keeping the holidays and everything else, and putting film, praying. Imagine yourself, you are starved to death, and it's Yom Kippur. And in Yom Kippur, you are going to fast. So people that had faith, a number of them survived. People that were agnostic, many of them, because of the dire situation in the camps, they committed suicide. So it's for later, but I just wanted to explain because it fits in.
Right, a little background, and thank God your family, your immediate family, ended up surviving the camps.
So let me go back to just one thing.
Sure.
First of all, I'm a Holocaust survivor, which means I was in one of the three type of camps. In 1991, another group of people were recognized, and those were people saved by strangers, hidden by them, lived in the sewer, in the forest. Okay, they are called the hidden children. 46 years later, finally they were recognized. I am a child of Holocaust survivors, which means both of my parents survived. Like you said before, I am an educator. I served in the Israeli Air Force. And my mission in life is to educate the next generation. I'm the only one that talks about how did the Holocaust happen, going through the stages, and because people did not react appropriately in a timely manner, things kept escalating, you know, reached a point of no return. And I want especially the young people to see the signs of today and learn about the past and learn how to combat it, okay, and hopefully prevent future tragedies. It's important also to understand that we should not make any comparisons to the past. I'll just give you one example. Today, there are many countries that are accepting refugees. I don't know if your audience knows it or not, but during the Nazi regime, there were only three countries that officially accept the Jewish refugees: Dominican Republic, China, and Philippines. My uncle was not a survivor. He was a refugee in Shanghai. The next time we'll go more into it, but I want to understand for people not to make comparison, to learn from the past.
Absolutely. And I wanted this to be my last question, but since we brought it up pretty soon, and early on in the conversation, I had this written down. I did want to ask you because it is relevant. A survey found there's a shocking lack of Holocaust knowledge among people under 40. And as an educator, that, you know, that's very, very unfortunate as an educator and Holocaust survivor. Two-thirds did not know what Auschwitz was in the survey, and over 1 in 10 respondents did not recall ever hearing what the word Holocaust. Why do you think that is, and why is it so important for you to share your story?
Well, one of the interesting things what happened to me is I was at the Chabad house, and I had Jewish students, okay, from university. And they had family members that went through the Holocaust, lost some family members. And I asked them, how did it happen? How was it possible? And to my shock, and I'm not talking about non-Jewish kids, I'm talking about here people that had family that went through the Holocaust. They were totally clueless. And that gave me the idea, and I'm the only Holocaust survivor today, unfortunately, to the best of my knowledge, that instead of eliciting empathy, and not that the other survivors are eliciting empathy, but by talking about what happened to them, in going into details, you automatically feel empathy. I don't. For me, is to educate them. Okay, how did it happen? And one of the things is, from my perspective, I would like to see the young people, because all of the changes in the world have been accomplished by young people. I want the young people to take example from Martin Luther King Jr. to unite, march nationwide. And the next time, or on the third portion, remind me, you can write it down, ask me about the national rally called No Fear. I want to bring other people, not only the Jewish people. And we have a tendency not to react appropriately. To give an example, every ethnic group that came to the United States has been persecuted. No question about it. Take a look, for instance, the Irish, the Italians. In your face, they were marching. The media took notice of it, and eventually they became integrated. The Jews laid back. We help every other ethnic group. When are we learn to stand up for ourselves? That is the main message for me, besides learning from history, is to teach them, okay, that it's up to them. Okay, my generation is not going to make any changes anymore. We are too old for that, too dumb. Okay, we lived our lives whichever way we did. It's up to them, okay, to make the difference and to get rid of this hate. And I have to say one other thing with your permission.
Absolutely.
There is one virus that can never be eradicated. That is the virus of bullying, bigotry, Jew hatred, racism, ideology. There is only one way that we can combat it, and that is education.
Absolutely.
And we will talk more about it because, unfortunately, and I unequivocally, I can tell you, in this country, there is no education, there is indoctrination. And I can give you personal examples.
If we have time, if you want to share one personal example, we'll cover a lot of that in part two, but if you had a personal example to share.
Years ago, I found out that there were, I think, 14 states that today there are 22 that required, mandated, genocide, Holocaust curriculum. I spoke for 7 years in a row to 735 seventh graders in Bayonne, New Jersey. The teacher, Gene Woods, he wrote a wonderful curriculum, fully accredited by the state of New Jersey. And one day after the curiosity, he says, look, you wrote, okay, the history of it, how it happened. You're talking about the genocide, about the Holocaust, human rights. How many students, he's a history teacher, how many students have taken your course? He said 50. I said, Gene, this is a state that mandates, requires, okay, genocide, Holocaust curriculum. How come only 50? He said it's an elective course. We have to be very precise with the words because it gives the wrong misinformation if you don't use the proper words. So it makes you feel good. Oh, it's mandated. But it's not. okay, fulfilled. I'll give you another example, the importance of words. I do not like the word anti-Semitism. Are you surprised?
Tell me why.
Because there are three groups of people that are Semites: Jews, Arabs, and Ethiopians. So an Arab can say the most vile things against Jews, against the state of Israel, and legitimately claim, I am not an anti-Semite. Therefore, we have to use the proper words. We have to be precise. Yes. Okay. And to say Jew hatred or anti-Jew. And Jew hatred is distinct from hate. Okay. And there have been attempts in Congress to have different resolutions for Jew hatred and hate. People lumped them together, and it became a meaningless resolution. It's not Jew hatred against Jew hatred. It's not against hate. It's nothing. Watershed. So that's why we'll talk more about it, but we have to be very, very precise with the words that we use, because words mean different things to different people, depending on your background, how you interpret, and everything else. So if we want to speak the same language, we have to, I'll give you one other example. People use the word Nazi. There are no Nazis today. There are people that believe in the Nazi ideology. We have to call them neo-Nazi. When you use the word Nazi, you're talking about the past. You're using neo-Nazi. You're talking about the present. You can see now the difference. But people, you know, don't think in those terms, and they use the word Nazi like it's...
just throw it around. Yeah.
Throw it around. So we'll talk more about it, but that is very, very important to be very precise. And in all my presentations, I am very positive. And if you pay attention, very seldom will I use a negative word. And if I do, and if I catch it, I will immediately correct myself.
Right. So that pretty much concludes our introduction to your life story. We got a good background. We know about your family. We know about where you were born, where you grew up, a little bit about that. We learned why this is so important to you. And I'm very, very much looking forward to documenting part two and part three. And like I said in the beginning, it's so important as time goes on, you know, the education is declining. A lot of these classes aren't required. A lot of people are sort of forgetting. So it's really important for me, just as a human being, to document your story and get it down on video, to be able to share this for generations to come. So it's very important.
But by the way, I have a request from you.
Sure.
If you have the connections, I would like to speak to the people from Middle East. Okay. I prefer in person, but we can also do it, you know, to reach a large group of people also online. Syrians, people from Iran, from Iraq, Morocco. Because a lot of them, they don't know. In Iran, for instance, you had the Farhud, okay?
Right.
But it's a different type. It was not really the Holocaust. It's more of a genocide. So you had problems there. But most, especially the young people, do not know about the Holocaust. They heard about it, but they do not know. And it's important to understand what hate can do to a person, what hate can do to a group of people. So you may not have the to know, but maybe you have the connections, okay, to put me in touch. And I would love to be able to speak to an audience. Okay.
I think I might have some connections. I'm gonna try to see what I can do. So it'll be a nice project, so it could educate the next generation.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And obviously, I would love to also to learn from them, to learn from you. Okay, we'll talk more about it, especially when you come to my place. So I want to know more about your heritage, which unfortunately, okay, I don't know too much about. I heard many stories, but it's not the same thing what's in the news and what the reality is. They're two different things.
Absolutely. I'd love to. And we're gonna we'll schedule part two and part three over email.
By the way, like I said before, you can ask me questions on any subject that you want.
Will do. I appreciate it.
I will be very honest, and I'm not asking you to agree with me. I'm asking the audience to respect that I have a different opinion. That's all I'm asking.
That's how everyone should be. No one should judge a person by their opinions. Everyone should just keep an open mind and be tolerant.
Jeremy, thank you very, very much. You honor me. I'm very honored, and I'm looking forward, okay, to meet you in person.
Absolutely. And the honor is mine. I'm honored to be speaking with you, and thank you so much for sharing your story. I truly am humbled. And we'll figure out over email the meeting in person, and we could do the interviews there, hopefully within the next 2 weeks if that works for you.
Yes.
Let's do it. All
Okay.
right, Sammy.
Except on July 21 and 28, I will be in Atlanta. There is a teacher symposium on Tuesday on the 26th. I will be the keynote speaker.
Okay, so very busy. So we'll plan around that.
Yes.
All right,
Okay.
I'm looking.
And the other thing is, you probably know by now, I'm right now, quote unquote, I'm right now an author. I have a published book. It's basically my website in print,
Okay.
but it's on Amazon. You can check it out.
All right, so for anyone listening, Sammy has a book on Amazon if you want to go check that out and support him. All right, Sammy, thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to documenting the rest of your story. Take
Thank
care.
you, Jeremy. Thank you.
Have a great
Okay.
rest of your day. Bye.
But you too.